Welcome to the Parent Equation Podcast with me, Aisha Murray. This podcast series is full of inspiring stories from working parents who are passionate about designing a life that works for them and their families. Working parents like you who want a purposeful, rewarding career alongside a balanced family life. I am joined today by Paul Morgan Bentley. Paul is an award-winning investigative journalist and also the author of The Equal Parent. So welcome, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
So the first question would be, what was the catalyst behind the book, The Equal Parent? Because I think that came as a, not a side hustle, but it wasn't your sort of main career, I suppose, writing books and novels. So where did that catalyst come from?
Yeah, so I'm a journalist at The Times in London, and I'm married to Robin, my husband, and we have a son who's now three, Solly. And I hadn't planned to write a book like this, but we had Solly, and our kind of formative experience and the experience that really was kind of impossible for us to ignore was how little was expected of us as fathers. And I think coming to parenthood as a gay male couple, we definitely assumed beforehand that that would be at the forefront, that people hopefully would be accepting, but that we'd get lots of questions, you know, what's it like as a two-dad family? And we did get some of that, but actually much less than we thought we would. You know, generally, we find we just kind of plod along like everyone else. And we are, I guess, technically quite an unusual family still, but actually not in reality. We're all just doing the same stuff. But we found, particularly very early on with a newborn baby, that we were getting two things, either lots and lots of praise for real basics that women would never get praise for. So, you know, turning up at his first vaccination appointment and the doctor and nurse saying things like, wow, a dad, we never see dads. Like, oh, have you taken time off work? All that kind of stuff. And that carries on, actually. Quite recently, I got praised at the chemist for picking up a prescription for Solly. And, you know, the woman behind the counter said something like, oh, it's so great to see dads doing stuff like this. And, you know, I was doing the very basics. I was picking up a prescription. So that was one half, the kind of loads of praise, which we were enjoying, but also made us realize this is ridiculous. You know, we've got lots of female friends. I've got sisters. They would never get praised for this. But also then a really low expectation of dads. I guess it goes hand in hand, but the kind of really patronizing stuff, like, you know, a lot in the media, the kind of useless dad stereotype, like, oh, dad's forgotten the sun cream, or, you know, or dad can't be trusted on his own type of stuff. And so that kind of bothered us. And we started talking about it, me and Robin, and there was one particular trigger, actually. One night after a night feed with Solly, he was kind of on my chest, and I was scrolling on my phone, and, you know, he was sleeping on my chest, and I was kind of, you know, stuck on the couch and didn't fancy getting up quite yet. And I was looking at kind of online advice pages for dads specifically. And there was an NHS hospital website I came across, which actually is the kind of how I go into the book in the introduction. But it was just so patronizing and expected so little of fathers. And it talked of things like, you know, the mother will be looking after the baby and she may not have family and friends around. So make sure you're around as well, just in case. And
Kate had forgotten that you might be part of this equation.
Exactly. And you know what? I think it just felt really significant as a huge problem facing kind of this generation of parents, where we've grown up rightly with the expectation that women are equal at work, but at the same time, there's no expectation of equality at home. And it feels like this flux period and a really important question for our society at the moment, which is how do we get equality at work for women if we still don't expect equality at home? And it's tied up with lots of ideas about motherhood and the importance of women. And that's obviously great. But at the same time, we should, I think, be celebrating fathers and not patronizing fathers, because it actually helps women. It helps everyone if men are seen as equal at home, I think. So I wanted to write a book about it, and hence The Equal Parent.
And do you feel then that because, I suppose, the support isn't there, ideal support isn't there for fathers, and the unpatronizing support is not there, do you find that then fathers potentially, especially given your work and the corporate environment you work in anyway, do you think then that there are more fathers who want to be there, but they feel it might be penalized by their employers or by, again, the perception of them if they want to say, actually, do you know what, I am a dad too. I can do everything that my mother does. But there might be a perception where the workplace says, oh, really? Well, then you're going to be, I don't know, not promoted or overlooked for things. Do you think that still exists as well within employers?
Yes, definitely. I think there's lots of different factors involved here. One of them is that if you're a mum who's given birth to a baby, you've just been pregnant, given birth, you're obviously going to take maternity leave and you could share it, but often women end up taking on the bulk. And then because you're around more at the beginning, you get better at doing things. You're the one that does get them to sleep quicker because you're the one that's been doing it more and more. And dads get to this point where they can feel like they are the secondary parent. Mm. And that's all a big part of it as well. But definitely also at work, I think now we often have a generation of men in leadership roles who didn't do this stuff. And so the men in the kind of middle kind of rungs, not the beginning of their careers, but also not necessarily leading organizations, big corporate businesses, then feel like they cannot be honest about the sacrifices that you have to make after having kids. And it is true, we should be honest about it. You have a child and you do have this massive other responsibility. So you do have to leave work at four sometimes because you have to pick them up before six. And I've had that feeling, and I'm sure lots of other people have, where you feel like the worst employee in the world because you're leaving at four. But at the same time, the worst parent in the world because your child's been at nursery until six from eight in the morning. You're like, you're getting everything wrong. And I think it's kind of the cowardly thing as a man in that situation to do is to avoid that and to think that, well, no one's expecting this of me. So I'm either going to quietly go off and pretend I've got another meeting or I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And I think actually there's a huge responsibility for men to be brave in that way at work and to be really open. I think women often don't have the choice. They usually don't have the choice. Most mothers have been pregnant. And so their kind of status shows physically. They walk around the office and people can see they're expecting. And people might make judgments about that. Whereas men can kind of pass. And people think of women as mothers at work, but don't think of men as fathers at work. And I had this, and I definitely, after having my son, no one expected anything to change. I went away for a couple of weeks for work at one point, and it was nice on the one hand that no one expected me to do anything differently. On the other hand, it would have been nice for someone to have said, oh, this must be quite tough. How are you going to manage it? So I think actually men have an extra responsibility to be really loud about it and to say, I'm picking up my kid from nursery, or, you know, I'll log back on at 8 o'clock after I've put my son to bed, even more than women, because women don't have that choice and it's just announced by their bodies.
Yeah, true. I'm going back to your two dad household.
Yeah.
And if you think about, again, this is traditional expectations, and this is absolutely not my point of view, but if you think about traditional expectation, and as you said, for the woman, it's evident she's pregnant at work. And for the man, there's a stereotypical sort of, oh, obviously you're going to take 2 weeks off only, and then you'll be back at work, nothing's happened, etc. In a two dad household, is there a different balance between you and Robin when it comes to, and again, these aren't words I like to use, primary and secondary caregiver. I know we sort of use those outwardly, because there are two dads in the relationship and there's then a different expectation from the outside world, different perception, I suppose, in the outside world, because there isn't the female who's had the baby and everyone's witnessed the pregnancy for 9 months prior.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think beforehand, we'd have said we were going to try to do everything 50-50. And actually, the reality is that doesn't work for us anyway. We are kind of obsessed with parenting equally. And more what we've realized is it's about the responsibility and the mental load. And so that doesn't mean doing 50-50 of everything. It means primarily we both have to be able to do everything. You can't get in a situation where only one of you can put to bed. Because then if the other one is held up at work or the other one has to go away for work, it causes panic and that doesn't work. So you all have to, everyone has to do, both of you, if there's two of you, have to do everything equally. Yeah, because obviously they're single parents as well. But also what we found is we do defer to each other in different ways. And it is quite interesting, I think. I took the first half of parental leave. So I think as a same-sex couple, you can be very practical. There's no societal pressure on one of you that you're a terrible mother if you only take 6 months off, and or that you're a emasculated man if you take more than 2 weeks off. Like, we just split it down the middle, did 50-50 and couldn't have cared less what anyone thought. But because I took the first half, and that was all, you know, newborn baby, feeding, sleeping. I was obsessed with schedules and trying to get him sleeping through the night and cutting down naps and that kind of, I remember being really surprised at not imagining that parenting would be so strategic, like being a project manager. And maybe I just took to parenting in a weird way. But I kind of quite quickly realized, no, this is, you know, I just have to be organized. And anyway, that was my kind of obsession. And still now I'm the one that kind of gets quite stressed about if he's sleeping through the night. We've just got rid of he had a dummy until he was three, and we've just got rid of it. And it's going really well, but he's taking longer to get to sleep. And I'm the one that's kind of like getting quite stressed about that. And whereas Robin took over from 6 months, and his first kind of big responsibility on his own really was weaning, because that happens around then. And Robin is definitely much more obsessed with food. He kind of jokes that if he didn't do the food shop, I'd like get down to the last celery or something, and that before realizing that I had to go and get some food. So we kind of take on the mental load in different ways. And then we also just, you know, we have arguments about it. I think, you know, and that's totally normal. And we try not to let things fester. And, you know, if one of us feels like the other one could, if they feel like they're kind of being overburdened, just trying to kind of bring it up and deal with it that way. But yeah, it's definitely not turned out to be a kind of, we both do 50-50 of everything.
Yeah, and as you say, there's different, we bring different skills to the relationship, don't we, and to the parenting. But I think the interesting thing you said there is because you split it 50-50 and you both had a good chunk of time to, I suppose, to assess what your parenting style was going to be, to work it out individually without the other person around. And you, and as you said, have different strengths in different areas. So my husband traditionally, well, it was 13 years ago, we gave birth to our daughter, and he had his 2 weeks off. I think he was given 3 weeks off. I think he got an extra week. And that 3 weeks, obviously, at the beginning is pretty much just sort of panic stations and no one really knows what's going on. Then when it actually comes to the point of deciding how you're going to parent and the kind of parent you want to be and how you're going to work things out, he's back at work.
Yeah.
So actually, for that traditional expectation for fathers traditionally, or those who are going, anyone who's going back quite quickly, they're not given that chance actually in that first year of the child's becoming the person they're going to become. They haven't got a chance to actually understand how they're going to be with that child and how they want the relationship to pan out. So they're already on a back foot quite early. And the person who's taken the extended leave is potentially, I suppose, forging a path that may not align with the other person. So yeah, what you had was perfect in that sense.
Well, then you can get into a situation definitely where dads lose loads of confidence, particularly with young babies, and feel like, well, I can't do it. I can't. She's just screaming out for mum all the time, and then can feel quite undermined and the other parent takes over. And equally, women can be criticised for being overly controlling because they've established all these patterns. And then it is really hard to let go and just let someone else take over. You can feel really protective. And we had that to an extent, I think, because I went first. I definitely had my ways of doing things. And I had to really teach myself to let go and not to say, oh, no, that's not how you do it. And actually, it was interesting in writing the book. There's actually really good research now that shows that not only is it good for the parents to be able to let go in those moments, but it's actually really, really fundamental for children to learn that their parents do things in different ways. And that, you know, mum cuts the toast up in a certain way and dad rips it up. And actually, it tastes the same either way. And I don't have to get really stressed out that it's not cut in that way because they both do it. And actually, when dad does it, he also adds a bit of jam and I like that or whatever. And it's to do, they think, with kind of forming really early on an understanding of empathy and that people are different. And that's really kind of fundamental social skills for them to learn. So it actually doesn't do them any harm. And it's actually reassuring as well in terms of childcare. It's really good for kids to have a few different stable attachment figures rather than kind of one obsessive one that they feel if they're not there, my whole world collapses. But the other thing that we found is if you can get to a point where you just totally trust your partner. And I don't mean by that the type of relationship where, yes, they're doing the nursery run, but you're still packing the bag, or they're calling you up when you're in the office and saying, where's the bath stuff for her? I can't find it, whatever. And they just get on with it by themselves. Then you can really let go when you go to work. And with my husband, there was one line in the book that he asked me to change. And it was, I'd written that the commute to work was the highlight of my week. And he said, can you just change that to a highlight of my week? Sound like you hate us. And being on a packed cheek carriage is your favorite part of the week. But genuinely, I love it. And it's that when you totally trust your partner to look after your child, then when you're at work, you can totally focus. You can get on that train and have your me time and not think, oh, has he packed the bag correctly? Because actually, if he packs it wrong, what's going to happen? Your kid's going to survive, you know, they'll be fine. So that's a really key part of it as well that I found in through our experiences, but also through looking at the research, that being able to switch off properly, don't leave lists if you can avoid it. You know, don't still worry, is he doing it correctly? He'll do it his own way, he'll get it done.
Yeah, and there's two things I think that came out when I was thinking when you talk about that. One is perfectionism. And actually, being a perfectionist as a parent is kind of a losing battle because who knows, you know, none of us know really what we're doing and what's, you know, there is no right answer to any of this stuff. So just being good enough is absolutely fine. As you say, the kids are fine. They'll get through it. They'll work their own way through these things anyway. So I think that's an important part to take away. And the second thing was guilt and parental guilt, because if you can release yourself, relinquish those feelings of control and say, actually, my kid will be fine. The other parent can look after them equally as well. Then not only do you have that headspace to just let go on the commute or wherever, but hopefully the guilt also goes away that, you know, I'm leaving my child. I hope they'll be okay. I feel guilty for leaving them. I feel guilty for not spending enough time with them. All those sort of feelings. You know they're in safe hands.
Mm. It's really hard because we get told all these things as parents that are supposedly so important. And so everything feels so high stakes and every decision is met with such judgment. You know, I said before that Solly had a dummy till he was three. We got comments and he didn't even have it that much, but he always had it for bed and we loved it. He slept really well and that was really important. But, you know, there's research about this and research about that and everything makes you feel guilty. And actually, if you can find a way of totally letting that go, and I do think it's easier for men, you know, I do absolutely recognize that I haven't come to parents with decades of societal expectation on what it means to be a good mother and what it means to be a bad mother. And, you know, if you're going to work, does that make you a bad mother? Well, actually, the science shows it doesn't. It's actually really good for your kid to have, as long as it's kind of stable and good quality childcare, that's actually really good for them. But I'm aware that as a man, it's a bit easier for me not to feel that guilt as much. I still feel it a bit, but I think not as much.
And I talk about, a lot about role modelling in these conversations. So there's obviously then the role model that you and Robin are going to be for Solly as he grows up and, you know, sees the equal parenting and I suppose the values are instilling in him through your parenting and through your relationship. Then there's also obviously the role model that you had when you were growing up. And I wonder how much do you feel that your upbringing and what you witnessed and experienced has influenced the way that you now want to parent?
It's interesting because my parents had a much more traditional arrangement which is very typical of their time, where my dad was the breadwinner and my mum was at home. But I was also I was one of four children. So I don't think I had a very like intense one-on-one relationship with my mum at home. We all kind of just got on with it. I think it's more for us to do with coming at this as a same-sex couple and just kind of coming to it fresh with a fresh perspective and not feeling like we have to do things in certain ways. And then just feeling really passionately about the equality side of things and that, you know, why would it, when we were thinking about parental leave, you know, why would it be fair for only one of us to have that time with our son? But equally also, why would it be fair for only one of us to make the career sacrifice? And something that does kind of bother me when I hear it is people so often say, or a woman will say, I didn't want to quit my job, but I've quit it because my salary didn't cover the nursery fees. And it bothers me because why are couples just looking at her salaries? Now, actually, in my opinion, the most kind of rational, practical thing to do would be look at your household income, see how you cover the nursery fees, and then think of both of your careers long term. Because right now it might seem like that's the logical decision, but as we all know, that leads to then, well, lo and behold, when it comes to who does a day less at work, when it comes to kind of down the line, you have another kid, it keeps going. And then before you know it, you've been out of work for 10 years, you've lost all your confidence. And meanwhile, your partner who's been going to work has been promoted. And then there's a huge disparity. And you kind of see it in couples. And I think the research backs this up as well, that often it's actually an illogical financial decision. Even in couples where women earn more, they're the ones that are more likely to cut down the hours. I think more equal parenting for us, because in the end, it's not about doing 50-50 of everything. What it allows you to do is play to your strengths, you know, so you don't have to, it's ridiculous, this idea of kind of masculine roles and feminine roles. I was speaking to a lesbian mum recently on a panel, and she said she's like a few times been asked the question, who takes the bins out? As if that's like only men can schlep a bin out, you know, it's ridiculous. And similarly for us, we can kind of just like fit into our patterns and hopefully play to our strengths.
Just for the record, I take the bins out in our house.
Well, what a manly thing to do.
It's ridiculous. But I think the 50-50 thing, I think, again, playing to your strengths is, and it's about honesty, transparency, openness, and trust between two people of whatever sex. Where do I need help and support? Where do you need help and support? What works for you? What works for me? What works as a couple? Not what is the perception in the outside world of what we should be doing. And I think that's potentially where people go, talking about your financial example there, sort of knee-jerk reaction is, oh, we're expected to obviously look at her salary because that's what we've been brought up to believe. Instead of saying, what do we need as a couple and as a family? And trying to just sort of put ourselves in a little bubble, really, and bat away all of those expectations, which is very difficult when we've been brought up with those role modeled expectations. So what would your advice be to couples of any sex on trying to find that openness, I suppose, that transparency? Where should people start with those conversations?
There's an interesting example I found when I was writing the book about kind of antenatal classes and how they can really help when it comes to parenting. And so often what they're about is they're kind of classes for mums where the partners get dragged along, is how they kind of feel to people. And there are different approaches. And, you know, there are some really good examples where they just focus on dads and showing them that practically they can do this stuff. You don't have to be a woman to hold a child to your chest and comfort them and all that kind of stuff. But actually, there's a really interesting example from America that's had amazing results. And I can't remember off the top of my head which university it was. But their approach was to take the couples and show them that it was problem solving as a team. It was basically all about working collaboratively as a team. You've got this huge responsibility and huge task, and it's not fair for it ultimately to be the woman's responsibility. And the man helps out. He changes some nappies, which is where I think we've got to as a society. We should recognize that men do much more as dads than our parents' generation did. Yeah. Men are at the birth. Men change nappies. Men, you know, do when you do the nursery run or school run, you do see men increasingly. But what the typical situation is that the woman is the primary parent and the man is helping out, even if she's working as hard as him professionally. And so actually, instead of it looking, when you're looking at the responsibility, seeing that as a team, and then you're kind of taking on each challenge as a team rather than one person feeling that responsibility. I think more than the physical work of parenting, you know, the thing that can really get you down or really kind of weigh on you is the mental responsibility. It's kind of sharing, finding ways to share that so you can both switch off at times is really important.
Yeah, I think several women I've spoken to over my coaching career, I suppose, they put themselves in a sort of, in almost like a martyr situation because they're not, they don't want to ask for help for whatever reason. Again, the guilt, the expectations of what's, you know, being a good mom, etc. But it becomes then this martyr situation where because they're not asking for help, the other partner doesn't know they need help because they're not saying anything. So then it's like, well, you're not helping me. Well, because you haven't, I didn't know you needed help, you haven't asked. And you end up in sort of in this loop of one person taking on more because they feel they should.
Yeah.
But actually just have a conversation about it. Just be open.
I think also the other person knowing what it's like to have that full weight of responsibility. And we've had this before where I think partly because I went first on parental leave, that there can be if our son is kind of clingy to either of us, it's usually me. And we learned actually that sometimes I just need to leave. I just need to give my husband space. And so, you know, we've timed it before. If during bedtime, if we're both in the house, he calls for me, then sometimes, you know, I'll do the food shop or something at that time. You know, Robin will send me out with an errand or something and just be like, can you just get out? Like, it's not personal. I love you, but you can't be here. And then sometimes it's just like one evening of me being at the office late and it resets again. And it, you know, you have to trust your partner to do that. But it also means that they then are not being shielded from the weight of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think some people could, I think because of kind of all this societal pressure around women, there can be this weird subconscious idea that men can't do it. And I've looked at the science for my book. I mean, I feel it very passionately myself that, you know, yes, we can't be pregnant or give birth, but we can absolutely take responsibility for looking after a baby. And there's nothing biologically that stops that. And the science absolutely backs that up. You know, we talk about maternal instincts and we talk about the mother's bonds with babies. And actually, fathers, scientists have scanned new parents' brains and can show now that those key hormones go just as high in men, even though they haven't been through pregnancy and childbirth, as women, as long as they're involved. And they're, you know, if you're an absent father, you don't, that doesn't happen to you. But men who are properly doing childcare, changing the nappies, holding their babies to themselves, waking up in the night, doing all those things, the parts of the brain that to do with bonding are just as high, just as intense as new mothers. And actually, men can also have the same alertness to their babies' cries as new mothers as well. So that kind of mother's instinct, actually, it's not to do with your sex necessarily. It's to do with just showing up and doing it.
But it's also for people to allow the father to show up and do it.
That's exactly what I was about to say as well. Yeah. So you have to, it can be a real challenge, but you kind of have to allow them the space to just do it.
I remember it might be different now and you've had your child more recently, so it may be different. But again, 13 years ago, I remember being in hospital in labour and no one spoke to my husband. He was just sat in a corner on the chair. Everyone was focused on me. Right. And, you know, obviously they need to focus on me because I was going through the process, but no one ever asked how he was. And I don't think anyone even introduced themselves to him. It's kind of like, all right, you're the dad. You sit there, be quiet. We're going to, you know, get this baby out. And it was just, if someone then had just said, you know, come here, let's talk to you. How are you feeling about all this? But it didn't happen. So
it's
even
really interesting
on,
you say that, because I think it's got worse. And actually, as part of the book, the first chapter in the book is about that, the first few moments of a child's life and how important those initial moments, skin-to-skin contact, is for men as well as women. And I did freedom of information requests to UK hospitals, and each has their own policy, but most, after the birth, treat fathers as visitors. In some cases, they're only allowed in the ward as little as 1 hour per day. And actually, I think it's really important, you know, you set the expectation that the baby is out of the mother's body now. Mm-hmm. It can be a shared responsibility now. If the mum wants it as well, then absolutely, not only should he be encouraged to be there, but this is the key moment. You know, it's not entirely her responsibility anymore. Yeah. And actually, you're 100% right. That is what happens. Men aren't talked to. There's loads of research in this area. They're not addressed. They're not invited to appointments. Even, you know, obviously the mum is the focus and the baby is the focus. But at the moment, it's nothing. And it wouldn't take much for the midwives to, and it's not their fault, they're really overworked and busy, but for it to be part of it, that they also are addressing dad and or partner, and making sure the partner also, you know, showing him how to bath the baby, or showing him how to change the nappy, supporting him, and really establishing that idea that it's a shared responsibility now. But that doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen in the antenatal appointments, and it doesn't happen in the post-birth appointments either. The way it is at the moment in the NHS is very much a suspicion of dads, because they might be abusive. And it's absolutely the case that some men are abusive, and domestic violence can go up in pregnancy and after having babies. So that is really important. But actually, by addressing the dad and checking in with them, not only are you more able to do that, but in the vast majority of cases, the dad just wants to be a really good dad. Mm-hmm. And we're missing opportunities to support them and establish the responsibility as shared.
It's interesting you use the word suspicion, because that's exactly what happened again with our first child, is that because she was born with low blood sugar, she was having these sort of, we called it Tommy Cooper moments. So she was having sort of fits in her hands, sort of general, sort of not seizures so much, but sort of jerky hand movements when she was literally just born in the sort of little cot thing next to the bed. And the immediate assumption was that something was going on, had gone on during my pregnancy. So they removed me from him, from my husband, and they said, you stay there, David, and we're going off to speak to Aisha, in a private room. I'd just given birth, so I was not really mindset for that. And they basically asked me if I'd been taking class A drugs while I was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
Because maybe the baby was having withdrawal symptoms. And the reason they didn't want him in the room is because he could have been the one who was coercing me into taking these drugs, whatever it was. So within 15 minutes of giving birth, they hadn't spoken to him and introduced themselves in the actual, you know, in the delivery room. And then they'd taken me off for a secret conversation about how he might be, have somehow coerced me into taking drugs around pregnancy in about 15 minutes. And I said, no, of course I haven't. That's not what's happening here. Yeah. And they said, oh, no, actually, no, it's because you've got like low blood sugar and she needs a bit of this and a bit of that, whatever. And lo and behold, a couple of hours later, she's absolutely fine. But his first experience, and again, I can't speak on his behalf, but his first hour of birth and new fatherhood and his first baby was suspicion and mistrust and feeling, you know, not included in the conversations. So where does that then go? You know, eventually.
I think the point is that the conversation around equality cannot just be about workplaces. It's all very well saying that women should be equal at work. That does not happen unless there's equality in other parts of life. And that very much includes those formative moments when you have a child. Because actually, when you look at the gender pay gap, it's getting better, but then you start having children and the disparity is massive. And it's all to do with that, because we are transformed into this much more traditional existence after we have children. The expectation is this kind of 1970s existence where men are at work and women are at home. And that includes suspicion of fathers. And there's good reason for, you know, for health staff being very aware of domestic violence, of course. But lots of staff that I spoke to said the balance was wrong. And it's a very small minority of cases, significant minority, but that shouldn't mean that in the vast majority of cases, we're treating dads like they're abusers. Mm. And actually, lots of dads can have real effects from the labour, and obviously they're not the one going through it. And rightly, we support women after labour and we should support them more. But, you know, lots of dads have PTSD off. They've seen their partner lose loads of blood. Mm. Lots of dads go through the experience of thinking they're going to lose their partner and lose baby. And if your partner went through kind of a horrific car accident and lost lots of blood, you'd be expected to be at the hospital. The doctors would be treating you with compassion. They'd be addressing you. They'd be seeing how you are, seeing how you're coping. They'd check in with you afterwards. But you witness your partner giving birth and you're ignored, or you're kind of, and then you're sent home and treated like a visitor. You're told like, oh, go home and get some rest, as if you haven't done anything. But it can be a really traumatic thing. And that's totally unspoken at the moment.
Mm. What was your experience then as a same-sex couple with that birthing process experience? How did that impact on you?
So we went through surrogacy in the UK, and lots of people don't know much about it, but surrogacy is legal in the UK, but non-commercial. So you can't pay a woman to carry a child for you. Initially, we made embryos with an egg donor and someone who chose to remain anonymous, but it's Solly's legal right to have her details and potentially try and find her when he's 18. And we would absolutely support him in doing that. But then also we joined a surrogacy organization and then eventually met a woman called Rachel, who's now a very close friend of ours, and her husband, James, and their kids. And she, kind of way it worked through the organization, is she was in control. So we got a call to say she wanted to get to know us better. And then we went through a whole kind of long process before trying to conceive. And then we were lucky at the first transfer worked and she carried the embryo, carried Solly and gave birth to Solly. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience and really, really bonding. It was also incredibly difficult in some ways to get your head around the altruism, because someone's doing this for you, and the sickness and all those things just for us. although she talks about how it gave her a kind of huge sense of self-worth, and, you know, she can talk for hours about why she's done it. And also, she had two sons and very much didn't want any more children, but missed being pregnant. She loved being pregnant, and she even talked about enjoying childbirth, which I found really hard to keep. But in the end, what happened was, when Rachel gave birth, so we rented a cottage near where she lives in the Midlands. She actually went 9 days overdue. So we were up there, we were helping her with the school run and very much kind of involved in their lives. And then she went into labor and she had her husband next to her supporting her, but we were also in the room. And it was amazing. It was so magical. And Solly was born, and I cut the cord, and then we kind of all had cuddles, and Rachel had cuddles, and James and me and Robin as well with Solly, and we did skin to skin contact. We took our tops off, and then the hospital were brilliant and ended up having two rooms, one for us with Solly, one for Rachel, and she could come whenever she wanted. In the end, she just fell asleep and wanted to have some toast, and she joined us in the morning. But I remember that it was amazing, that first night with Solly, and just him being in the little cot and sleeping, and we were just watching him and kind of terrified that he'd stop breathing, and all those things that I think every new parent must go through. And we definitely I felt such instant love for him, and also kind of real fear of responsibility and, oh my God, you know, this is such a huge responsibility. And then I remember quite soon after that thinking, I can't believe so many dads are sent home. And also, I can't believe women are expected to do this and have all this fear and all these feelings while also being usually trying to establish breastfeeding if they want to do that, and being in loads of pain and afterbirth, you know, after pains, or having a cesarean section, being postoperative, and their partner's sent home. You know, it's scandalous. And it's not the best thing for babies, and it's not the best thing to establish.
No. And again, exactly the same thing that happened to me. C-section, they were sent home.
Yeah, imagine you any other situation where you have an emergency operation and your partner's sent home. Mm. That wouldn't happen.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know the answer. I don't know why. Why does it happen?
The answer is that hospitals in the UK typically were built by a previous generation that very much did not expect men to be there. So now we're in a situation with an underfunded health service where maternity units are just not fit for purpose in lots of ways, including not having space for dads. And so understandably, if there are just kind of open wards, there can be situations where some women are particularly vulnerable or religious or don't want other men there. And so what's happening now is, as new hospitals are built in the UK, they're being built with kind of standard private rooms for free, but kind of private spaces for families. And there's a new big one being built in Leeds, very much where that has been said to be at the centre of it. There's one in Northumbria, which is kind of seen as a model where dads are very much included. But it's kind of this postcode lottery thing where if you happen to be in an area with a very old hospital, the dad's going to get kicked out. Mm-hmm. And that basically.
Mm-hmm. So with your book, and with, I suppose, the sort of newfound knowledge and all the research you've done for the book and experience of being a parent now, 3 years in, and your career, your successful career as a journalist, are these two paths going to now cross somehow? So sort of, I suppose, the author, child psychology, all the research side, and then your traditional investigative journalism. Can you see now where your career might start to go in a different direction because of all of these sort of conversations you're having?
No, I kind of like the separation. I like that I've written the book on the side. It was a hell of a lot of work and kind of was a real passion for me. So, for now, I'm very much focused on my career. And then this is something that I'm kind of passionate about on the side, and obviously balancing that with having a son, which is a lot of work, but it makes it much easier when you are sharing the responsibility genuinely. I think also something I've really realized after having Solly is I used to waste a lot of time at work. I think something people often talk about the challenges of going back to work, but actually I feel much more decisive. I feel much more confident and, you know, authoritative in some ways, like from that experience of being a parent. And, you know, there are things that I do at work now where I would have wasted nights kind of not sleeping with nerves or anticipation and overthinking, and don't have the time to do that anymore. And so you just get in there and you can be really decisive, and you can, you know, in some ways I can see my career going better after having a child, but for those reasons.
Yeah.
And just feeling confident about sometimes saying, well, I've got to switch off for a couple of hours and I might switch on later and I'll get my stuff done. I'm not going to just be there for the kind of face hours or just to kind of prove to everyone that I'm sat at this desk. You know, I've got stuff to do and I've got a limited number of hours to do it and I'm going to get it done.
Which again is something that's so hugely overlooked from employers and from, again, perception, is that actually becoming a parent does give you this decisiveness, this authority, this understanding actually of what you need, what other people need, makes you a much better employee. employee, I would suggest. But again, overlooked, you know, there's this term mummy tracking, where, you know, now that you're a mum, therefore that means you're going to be probably want to go part time, and you'll probably want to leave work early, and you'll probably want to do all these things. No one actually asked us if that's what we want. It's this expectation. Whereas actually the reality is being a parent brings a whole new level of insight, experience for an employer, potential employer. But again, not something that's discussed enough, I don't think.
It's short-term decisions that, you know, it seems, oh, she's going to have this huge other responsibility, she won't be fully focused. But what you're losing is someone who's gaining a huge amount of life experience and is still that same employee who's absolutely brilliant at their job. And, you know, had you kept that person or really invested in them, you'd be seeing the benefits. And, you know, I feel really passionate about that as well. And that if men are seen as just as responsible for childcare, that also means that workplaces can't discriminate against women of a certain age because they think, well, they'll probably not be committed, or they'll probably take parental leave because the same will be assumed of men. I think that's where we need to be working toward.
Can I ask you one final question about the industry you're in? Because I've had, again, conversations with working mums who have been in the news industry in some way or other, and have found the industry generally to be quite difficult to get flexibility in and to have that kind of progress with their careers while then having a young family. Again, with your, I suppose, the dad hat on, do you think that is true? And do you think maybe there's a way that, again, women in these kind of industries, which are full on, you know, news is a full on industry to be in, as many are, a way that actually we can be asking for more flexibility and an understanding of where we want to be, but our career is still important?
Yeah, absolutely. It can be a challenging industry, particularly news, because the job I do investigations, which allows me more flexibility. I'm working on exclusive news stories that take a long time, kind of long-term projects. And that means I can be more flexible. Earlier in my career, I was a news reporter, and that is extremely tricky. And now I'll look at new parents who did it and think, how the hell did you do it? Because part of the job is being so flexible that your boss can call you at any time and say, a bomb's gone off here, go get there, get on the next flight to Sweden, get on the next flight to Nigeria, you know, and you're just at the beck and call of someone. And that is pretty much impossible when you've got responsibility for a child. You cannot just book the next flight and go. You've got this huge other responsibility. But there are lots of different jobs within the industry. There are also, by having honest conversations, it could be the employers are more understanding. You know, if you have mums or dads who properly have responsibility for childcare in managerial positions, it means seeing that, okay, maybe that person isn't having the honest conversations to see, are you not able to do those kind of jobs and for a few years? If that's the case, fine. We'll get you doing other stuff. We'll get you more in control of what you're doing. But if people take short-term decisions and think, oh, you know, it doesn't suit them anymore, what you're losing is someone who has a huge new experience and understanding of the human condition. And what is journalism about, if not understanding readers, audiences, what they care about? And, you know, I definitely am much more attuned now to the types of stories that affect parents than I would have been before, because I wasn't a parent. I didn't understand what it meant to be a parent. And so again, it's that kind of, for employers, not being so short-sighted, because then what you end up with is newsrooms full of men who have never raised children and don't actually understand their readers. You know, readers are often mums.
Yep.
And yet you have kind of boardrooms full of people making editorial decisions who are not mums. And, you know, that it's short-sighted. I don't think you can't carry on with a career in the news industry, but it takes managers and editors with kind of seeing things long-term.
Yeah, and like I say, it's understanding there are other options out there.
Yeah, and you might want to tweak things. You know, if I were a news reporter still, I'd be saying to my bosses, I need to tweak things. But actually my job as it stands really does suit my life. So it's okay for the moment.
Good. Well, thank you so much, Paul. Thank you for coming on. It's been obviously a wealth of insight and experience, plus the book, etc. So if people want to find out more about you and your book, where can they find you?
So I have a website, paulmorganbentley.com, or if you search, if you Google my name, my articles for the Times come up as well. And then The Equal Parent, my book is on Amazon and at Waterstones in bookshops. So you should be able to find it by looking around, hopefully.
Perfect. It's a highly recommended read.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Absolutely. So thank you so much, Paul. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks. To work with me, find out more at aishamari.com, connect with me on LinkedIn, or check out my free resources and quizzes at aishamari.com/resources.